Amanda Pastelnik is doing research and teaching the area of law and neuroscience at Harvard Law at the moment. And she graduated from Yale Law and has practiced litigation. She's also counsel to the board of Network 2020. And I think you're going to talk about violence as well?
Yes, I am. Yes.
Amanda Pastelnik.
Thank you. First of all, thank you again to Roger for organizing this wonderful event. And also thanks to Walter and Aaron and Nita and Adam and some of the other people you're about to hear from who have really been developing the field of law and neuroscience. Yesterday, Owen Flanagan said that we should gather together all of the intellectually respectable disciplines. I'm not sure we lawyers necessarily would count as intellectually respectable in your world. And I'm not just making a lawyer joke, but lawyers are, by nature, we're something of interdisciplinary magpies. We try to optimize different sets of social constraints and values and pluck from different disciplines. This is why we have an array of law and fields, law and economics, law and literature, law and psychology, law and neuroscience now. But the hope is that each one of these areas can improve general models of human behavior, how we respond to incentives and penalties, how and why we cooperate with each other to basically increase pro-social behavior, decrease antisocial behavior, reduce costs of antisocial behavior, and costs of free riding. Law and economics was at this game for a long time, and now law and neuroscience is coming in, as it is in many other of the disciplines we've been hearing about today and yesterday. So the question is, where can neuroscience make a real contribution to legal doctrine? And one of the first areas that people, including legal people, tend to think of is in the criminal law, because no other area of the law seems to be so directly concerned with individual behavior and mental states. You know, what is the requirement for committing a crime? You need an actus reus, and a culpable mental state, your mens rea, your guilty or your evil intent. And so the question of what goes on inside the black box of the mind has been the province of people involved in criminal law studies for a long time. And this is, in fact, not the first time that the law has really tried to look to brain science to try to understand what makes some people criminals, particularly violent criminals, and other people not under highly similar circumstances. So currently, there are some people, you know, Walter was extremely cautious in his presentation, others are somewhat less cautious, in suggesting that we might be able to come up with a kind of a biological criminology or a modern biological criminology that will be able to tell us on a neurobiological level why some people are violent criminals and other people are not. This harkens back to a quite long history in the criminal law, three particular episodes, and I have some background in history of science, so I tend to approach most problems historically as well. Phrenology was, of course, the first major science of the mind, and I see some people smiling in the audience. It tends to elicit chuckles. There are statutes that were passed in the later 1800s in the U.S. banning the practice of phrenology along with fortune-telling and voodoo. It's considered the pseudoscience par excellence, but in its day, it had significant impact in the criminal law. And it drew on a modular theory of the mind-brain, the notion that you might have a larger or exaggerated area in your brain that related to lack of impulse control or destructiveness or a murder bump, or that you might be extremely a great wit because you have a large mountain for a bump of humor, as Mark Twain was told when a phrenologist examined him. This had tremendous impact in the criminal law, and although it was ultimately discredited, it did leave behind a sort of a modular theory of mind and behavior, as well as the notion that behavior is best understood entirely internally to the brain, in isolation. There was no argument that your skull had the shape that it did or your brain had the contours or functional abilities that it did because of anything having to do with your interaction in the social world, but rather that it was a quality totally inherent to and bounded by the individual. This was picked up in several subsequent attempts to integrate brain sciences with criminal law, including Lombroso's atavistic scientific criminology. This is the early 1900s comparisons between criminals and rats and lower carnivores and terrible scientific racism, which was again discarded after a brief period of great popularity. And then again in the middle of the 20th century, the rise of lobotomy as a tool of social control. The science informing lobotomy was substantially more sophisticated than anything that had come before it, and yet it was deployed, I think, for normative reasons within the criminal law in similarly misguided ways, targeting the individual brain as the not just an important locus, but the sole important locus of criminal behavior. So some of you in this audience may be familiar with the work of Drs. Mark, Irvin, and Sweet. They wrote a letter to the Journal of the American Medical Association saying, why do we have urban riots right now? There are African Americans living in conditions of terrible deprivation throughout these ghettos. Only some people riot. Why is that? Maybe the answer lies in an impulse control disorder resulting from a hypoactive prefrontal cortex. Maybe they have some overactivity in their amygdala. We ought to be able to help these people by intervening in their brains and reducing the triggers of their violent behavior. So although the science had tremendously improved by this time, the approach of looking at the individual as the most relevant level on which the criminal law acts had remained consistent. And this is not because these doctors and the lawyers who were picking up on their work were not inclined to think of broader social conditions or that they didn't recognize that we exist in context. But to some extent, I think it is a built-in feature of the way the criminal law itself encourages us to think. The criminal law tends to focus on individual adjudications of guilt or not guilt. We actually never say anybody's innocent. Did this person commit this particular act? If so, why? And what is the likelihood that he or she will commit such an act again? This does tend to drive to thinking about the individual and not thinking quite so much about the individual in context. And it often leads to a desire to look for individual predictors at the level of behavior and brain. So where does that lead us now? Certainly, some people do have brain disorders or defects. As Walter was just talking about, psychopathy is one area where there is a strong relationship between certain types of behavioral suites of features of conduct, certain levels of neural activation, and predispositions to criminality. But what his chart also showed very interestingly was that at the 10-year point of paroled violent offenders, 60% of the non-psychopaths also had recidivated in some violent way. So I'm not doubting that there are important applications in understanding how brain disorder relates to criminality, but I would suggest, and there is a great deal of evidence to suggest, that brain disorder and criminality are not necessarily as closely coupled as it would be convenient to believe. And in that case, if there is not such a close coupling between brain disorder and violent criminality, how can neuroscience, first of all, how can we explain violent criminality, and how can neuroscience make contributions to individuals and at a systems level where disorder, dysfunction, is not the problem? And I'll come back to that in a second, but before I do, I just want to set up an additional problem, and that is how we define disorder and dysfunction. There are some people who would suggest that if you see certain activation patterns on a brain scan that correlate with socially disfavored behavior, let me put it differently. If you see certain activation patterns on a brain scan that could correlate with socially disfavored behavior, really socially disfavored behavior like pedophilia, that raises the question of, is that a neurological disorder, or are you seeing neurological correlates of something else? So that's an important causation question that needs to be solved. And then there's the question of how we define disorder. Certainly everybody in this room would agree that pedophilia absolutely ought to be criminalized and that people who commit offenses against children need to be detained or otherwise incapacitated for the safety of society. However, for a long period of time in American history and still in some places in the world, homosexuality is criminalized. And if you saw patterns on a brain scan indicative of sexual arousal in response to gay porn and not in response to straight erotic images, that really raises the question of, are you seeing brain disorder? We would say normatively, from our cultural perspective now, no. And this means that with the exception of certain categories of extreme violence where there's no way that you could ever, that there could be rational disagreement about whether that constitutes a criminal offense, because there are norms that are shared across all cultures, what we define as a criminal offense, and even what we define as a violent criminal offense, contains a strongly normative component defined by social mores and also by the law. And if there's some doubt about whether a violent criminal offense could also be defined by social mores, two examples of that are domestic violence and the marital rape exception. Domestic violence is now widely believed to be, an offense of criminal violence, and is so treated in every U.S. jurisdiction. But the first statute to actually recognize domestic violence as a crime wasn't passed until 1977. So before that, the victims of those types of acts may have viewed such an act as violence. The perpetrators often may not have. There are many parts of the world in which domestic violence, what we would call domestic violence, is not only not viewed as violence, but as part of one's appropriate duties of keeping your family in line and keeping appropriate discipline. And so to be able to say that we can determine whether a person is or is not violent at a neurological level or has a predisposition to violence at a neurobiological level requires us to understand very carefully what are we defining as violence and how do norms and our basic biology interact with each other. So I'm not suggesting that there are no roles for looking at individual brain disorder. I think there is some very good evidence that some types of brain disorders do reliably lead to some types of acts that universally would be identified as prescribed violence, but that is, at present at least, an extremely small subset. And what I would suggest instead, and this might be in the nature of a candle, is that we rather look at kind of the basic first draft of neurological equipment that we may come into the world with. I think Jonathan Haidt was talking about that a little bit yesterday, and forgive me if I'm misattributing to the wrong speakers, that there may be systems that we have that can be primed to respond culturally to different triggers, but that are part of what it means to be human, whether it's the oxytocin system and trust, or basic emotions like disgust, or the tendency to make in-group, out-group distinctions. All of those general behavioral features can become shaped by culture in ways that lead to different rates of violence and different rates of criminality across place and time. So, for example, Elizabeth Phelps has done some wonderful work on amygdala response and fear to in-group, out-group distinctions. And how we are more likely to have a fearful response to those who are viewed as part of the outgroup. Fear does sometimes lead to violence, and there is at least a plausible story, a contestable story, but a plausible story, that would relate in-group, out-group distinctions and fear or disgust toward out-groups to rates of criminality like hate crimes, gang violence, or even suggest why political leaders may be able to push certain population buttons more easily than others to get groups to go to war with each other. And that if we were to understand how culture shapes who we view as our in-group and out-group, whether it's the Bloods or the Crips or the Korean grocer in the predominantly black neighborhood or any of the other ways that we might be making in-group, out-group distinctions, and then understand the roles that education and other structural or institutional level interventions can play in minimizing the types of negative behaviors that people tend to engage in, we might be able to use neuroscience at a more general level to create more pro-social institutions and reduce antisocial behavior and the costs therefrom more generally, and move away from some of the thorny and intractable problems of trying to correlate individual brain patterns with individual behavior, and also potentially of reifying normatively defined cultural standards as criminal or not criminal for all time, And we also, as a final point, might be able to avoid otherizing the criminal, because if we are primarily focused on looking at the neurological drivers or correlates of criminal behavior at the individual level, we risk turning the criminal into the biological other. And now, the first thing we have to do is have a commitment to that which is true. So if there are neurobiological differences that predictably lead to different rates of violence, then that is what it is. And if that leads to otherizing a certain subpopulation, then we have to figure out how to deal with that. We can't say we're not going to do it because we don't like it. But there has been a cultural tendency that I think we need to be on our guard against to say, well, if there are biological bases of criminality, look, there are rates of criminality that differ across populations. That group which has a higher rate of criminality must be biologically different from the rest of us. And that can lead to some of the types of racial and social invidious distinctions that are not only socially negative, but likely to be biologically false as well. So I am excited about the potential of neuroscience to contribute to behavioral level descriptions and figuring out how we can, for example, reduce rates of violence in highly pluralistic societies, or enhance cooperation, or use trust mechanisms to reduce the need for draconian enforcement systems. But I hope to see a great deal of work on that side of the law and neuroscience question, which also sort of tracks the way we've used law and economics for more general descriptions of behavior, and that will lead to many productive discussions in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.